The Jack B Show, where pit smarts meet street smarts. Now, here's your host, Jack Berugin.
Hey, welcome, everybody. Happy Tuesday to you. This is Jack Berugin. Happy 23rd of April, and I apologize for being away from you for a little bit. And again, a lot of that has to do with, I've got to make a living here, folks. You know what? We're running a few different businesses here. But during that week off, what a week to not be around, not be on the radio, not be on television, all of which happened last week. In fact, they had me scheduled for Larry Kudlow's show, but I got stuck down in Atlanta. We had a little weather problem here in Chicago. But before we even go there, my hearts and prayers and thoughts go out to the victims in Boston last week. It's something that I've been thinking about, haven't had a chance to talk about. And, of course, that horrible tragedy down in West Texas where we saw what happened down there. And, of course, you know, all of that revolving around, you know, the market's volatility, and we're seeing what's happening there too. But, you know, it's a good time to take a step back and maybe realize something that I remember writing in my book a few years ago, the one that Wiley published. Yes, folks, I wrote a book. Could be one of the few people that's written more than they've read. But, one of the things I wrote in there is only money. You can always get more. And, you know, one of the things that you remember after a week like yesterday, like last week, is that it is only money. You know, we can always get more at some time. You know, there are other and larger things and issues that seem to drive the market and drive life. And it's a good time to take that step back, take a deep breath, and understand that. But today we saw some very serious action in the market. Folks, I got to tell you something. If there was ever anybody, and all of a sudden you saw the people talking about high-frequency trading today, if you don't know what happened, we saw the markets move in a vicious manner, all right? To give you an idea, you know, someone that maybe heard a couple of hundred Dow points, all within a few minutes because of an AP, which was a fake AP report of a terrorist attack, now get this, folks, on the White House. So what happened? Of course, you know, somebody hacked into the AP Twitter feed. All right? Sound familiar, folks? In the old days, you know what? There was no Twitter feed. You had rumors that came off of trading desks. All right? And then, you know, they would just kind of float around the floor and they'd float on the street and you'd see the markets react to it. Well, these days, you know, this day and age, you no longer have that. This day and age, what we have here, folks, all right, is a situation where all it takes is some brilliant 18-year-old with some good savvy to be able to hack into the AP News Twitter feed and be able to drive the markets down in a, you know, I mean, vicious manner. Now, I say 18-year-old because that's what I'm hoping is the case. I'm hoping that it was not a concerted effort, you know, by some high-frequency shop because they've got a lot more to lose if that's the case. And I would hope that the investigators are out there paying not only attention to the markets that were affected, but to the ancillary markets. What do I mean by that? Look at every other market that might have moved accordingly and see if anybody actually profited, ridiculously from, you know, that normally wouldn't be in the markets, for example. All right. And, you know, I know I'm going to leave it to the investigators for that. Hard bounce today. And a lot of that is due to the fact that we're seeing the markets move. In fact, you're seeing them move, I think, because we're not getting as much of the negativity that was expected out of earnings season as was, I guess, projected over the course of the last month. Remember, coming into this earnings season, folks, what we had heard was expect the worst. We've got a slowdown in China. We have got the slowdown in Europe. Blah, 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 blah. You know, I am so tired of hearing about the naysayers. You know, I am glad that the Rubinis and the Talebs of the world are no longer getting the press that they were getting before. You know what? Right, and rightfully so, because they have been wrong. All right, I'll say it again. Wrong about just about everything. And the reality is that for them to get any more press, worse yet is Mark Faber. If they talk about him, Mr. Doom, Gloom, and Boom, one more time, all right, because these are the people that have been absolutely responsible for an entire generation that's lost purchasing power parity, and hopefully people will ignore them, just like they ignored the Granvilles of the world and the other people that had their 15 minutes of fame back in the old days. Big moves in commodities. In fact, I did a CNBC. They asked me to do street signs yesterday, something I normally don't do during the day, and a lot of that was because of the moves that we're seeing in commodity land. WTI, crude, of course. Amazing moves in gold. I mean, we're, of course, hearing about central bank selling of gold, but all of this adds to the situation and, more importantly, adds to what's going on. But here to help us really get a feel for what is going on is one of my favorite people on the show. And we're talking about Alan Rohrbeck. He's the founder of the Rohr Report. That's the Rohr-Report. And I know, Alan, you're doing a lot with the Bull and Bear guys, but welcome. I hope you're liking the new format that we're doing here without commercial interruption, which is always the way I like to do things.
You know what? It's a better format. It's what the audience wants these days in terms of everyone's pressurized for time. And, Jack, just one thing, though. I hope that means you also like me when I'm not on the show.
Well, you know what? Look, you're one of the few people that I will actually quote on the show when you're not on the show.
There we go.
You know what? And I'll say this in front of you because, you know, I know that your head's going to get big when I say that, but it's okay. Hey, listen, let's start a little bit right from the beginning here. You know, give me an idea of what you've seen these last couple of weeks. I've been watching the markets moving with some amazing volatility, you know, and I've been doing this from a distance, from a few thousand miles away. But give me your take on what all of this has meant. And then I'd love to get your take on today's plunge on that fake Twitter feed, only because I love the fact that what used to take hours is now taking a couple of seconds, you know, or a few minutes. And that's funny.
It's what our friend Aaron Reinglass, the mayor of the markets, calls the revenge of the machines.
You're right. You know what? It's instantaneous information. Right. But, you know, again, those are the kinds of things that you and I experienced on the floor, but they used to take hours.
I love the advance of the machines for many years because and all the technicians did, all the stuff where we used to, when you were first on the floor, there were still people being paid as chartists, keeping up point and figure charts manually. You had to go update your commodity perspective, the late great commodity perspective, by hand at the end of each day.
Alan, I'm going to date myself, but when I first started working on the floor, I'm going to give you an idea of how this book, the Bass Brothers were cornered, the Hunt Brothers were cornering the silver market, and one of my first jobs was to stand by the elevator and run to the silver pit and let our broker know that the Hunt Brothers broker was coming off of the elevator and walking towards the pit, because that meant he was going to take the market limit up. How about that?
There's something to be said for sentry work.
That is about as old as it gets.
It teaches you about how you have to be vigilant in the markets, both in life and in government, but also in the markets. Vigilance is a major asset.
Well, vigilance is something that hopefully people were last week, especially with all of this. But give me your take on what's going on.
But I heard a great comment that relates to some themes we've discussed before, with some of your primary themes. And the first is, you know, all of these ETFs, and you basically securitized gold. And it made it so much easier to get in for so many people who didn't have a clue why they were in and why they were holding it.
I was touching that on TV yesterday when I was on CNBC.
And so when it gets below an 18-month low, which it did when it broke through 15, 26 to 30, going back to Friday of the week before last, you come in last week, hey, guess what? There's nothing underneath it for $100. Why would anyone think it couldn't do that? The second thing is, and a great comment last week relates to something I put into our joint venture with Bull and Bear Institute, our Strat Report chat room today, which is look at gold rebound so nicely from a disaster, admittedly. It got sold down much worse than the other metals. But I heard someone say last week, forget gold. Just for the very reason we mentioned. Gold's a securitized item. It could be anywhere at any moment because of imbalances. He said, look at industrial metals. Look at copper, one of Jack Berusian's favorites in copper.
I tell you, I've been watching it down in the lower threes.
I'm a big fan. Also, it's continued down straight away, day by day, since the middle of last week when it first broke down below 340, it's down to 310. And you always say, you know, if it's down to 3.25 or 320, it's weak and it's constructive. If it gets down around 3, it's critical because
three. And what did I say on TV yesterday? I'm gonna tell you what are the things I said. And I really believe this is under 3, you start to worry about disinflationary pressure.
Right.
Over 3, you worry about inflationary pressure.
But not just over 3. Like it was up around 350. Well, or over.
You know what? Let me correct myself. Over 4. I'm going to say that. It's between 3 and 4 that tells me the health of the economy. Right. All right? In the lower 3s, it's weak. In the upper 3s, it's actually doing better.
Right.
Over 4, I start worrying about price instability. That's really the way I gauge copper and why I like it so much.
Well, and right now it's telling you that maybe... And the interesting thing that's happened, because as you know, I'm a multi-asset class international analyst, and what is happening is even when equities ran up to that new high, when the S&P went up to 1592.5 on the futures, the bond markets didn't break. They didn't sell off much at all. And as soon as it started coming off
last week. The bond markets
didn't
believe them, Alan. The bond markets,
looking, as we've said this many times, sorry to be redundant for the regular listeners, the bond market trades on the real-world data. The equities trade on hope and expectation. So the bond markets from a month and a half ago were under some pressure when equities were getting better. But then even as equities held up, the bonds started to come back up because they're looking at Europe weak. PMIs today were weak. German services PMI went below 50.
Why was the European market, all right, as a collective, all right, so much stronger this morning than you would expect, especially after that weak data?
I think it's QE.
All right, because I saw that coming in, and I knew that the data was weak. You saw the Italian parliament, and their troubles. But something was going on, Alan, that was more – and people don't know – people are not talking about it right now on television.
Right.
Nobody seemed to address it on TV because they – you know why? Because they don't know. All right? Why? But
right.
you have a feel for it. Talk to me and talk
well,
to us a little
one,
bit about what's going on.
Number one, you had a tremendous technical factor from the rally to the new high in the U.S. yesterday that took place after Europe closed. So you had a natural bear squeeze in Europe set up for today. Europe had hardly recovered at all from those lows last Thursday.
But you and I know Europe's got its own mind. They've got their own problems. They've got their own things to worry
about.
But
on the technical set... Europe has broken. That's a very good point, Jack, because Europe has broken much further. It's already below its February lows in the DAX, the German index, coming down to about 77.5 on the recent break. It was in truly critical territory against the long-term, like the 200-day moving average that the S&P is nowhere near right now. And what happened was that's around 77.5, and that meant those markets were critical, and the FTSE was down to a similarly critical support, not quite as depressed. So when you don't end up having the market act as weak, pardon me, that was actually a level around 60, low 62s in the FTSE. And in fact, it was not 77.5, it was 73.5 in the DAX.
Well, what's happening with the ECB? There's something happening that's happened over the course of the last 24, 48 hours that seems to have shifted and altered the minds of portfolio managers.
It's the rebellion against the austerity. When the German figures come in weaker, people start to get the idea the ECB is going to be under more pressure, even from the usual guardians of the anti-inflation psychology. There's going to be some political pressure coming out of Germany, even Germany, for the ECB to loosen up a bit and not worry about the inflation.
So Germany,
right,
the one hawk out there, if you were to think of it as far as countries
Germany
go,
and the Nordic friends up there.
Is basically the logic there that you're trying to tell
bad
me.
Bad news is good news because
for the fact that you're not going to get the hawks as hawkish as they normally would be.
Right. And the doves have already been dovish for months and months. You know, Hollande over in France, the Greeks, the Spanish are saying, loosen up. The austerity is weakening the GDP further, which creates a lower tax base. We're not solving the debt-to-GDP ratio with austerity, which is something I started writing up back in 2011. Is austerity really going to solve it, as opposed to what you know, Jack, and why we've been so successful and why we're in a goofy path right now, as opposed to labor market reforms. Get people to go to work for reasonable prices. You'll encourage your economy. This all gets back to the taxation thing you and I came up with.
Well, it's not only tax, but it sounds like
Arthur Laffer.
They need to become efficient. They need a good old-fashioned Abe/Reagan out there, all right, who is doing what's necessary.
Right.
Who's, you know what? I mean, a supply-sider, which is exactly really – Abe is a Reagan in disguise. I hate to say that, and I know there are a lot of Reaganites, you being one of them, that might be insulted by that.
You talk about the strength of Germany. You know who else did that? And they did it on a stealth basis. They couldn't promote it because it's antithetical to the culture. The Germans.
But the Germans did it while incorporating the East into the fold, which was very difficult to do at that time, if you remember correctly.
Even after that. But Schroeder risked and lost to Merkel, ultimately. Schroeder risked and lost pension reform and union work rule reform. And they say, well, the Germans are doing so well. Well, yeah, the Germans have put through the reforms already. The rest of Europe is being pushed to put through now. They're the most competitive economy, not just because they're higher tech than other guys, but because their work rules have eased up.
Here, before we leave Europe, Alan, where does that leave us with the European markets? I guess my point is, are we still looking at what are value levels, especially for markets like the DAX or the FTSE that have gotten, that have underperformed?
Exactly right.
And the other, I guess the other question along with that before we leave Europe is how much of the strength in the dollar has been affecting any kind of, or acting as a bit of a headwind towards what we see happening out there with these markets?
Well, first of all, the being back down, not against the 41-week average alone, but as the DAX was down in that 73.5 area, it also was back against a whole lot of previous trading historically, and even going back to September through November of last year, right around 63.5 is a key level. And if they were to break that, it would look very ugly. But they're back up now, all the way back up in the 76s. So the technical setup is, they got down to a more critical level and relied on the U.S. to help them back up. And similarly, but you know, U.K. economies had some very weak economic data as well. And in a similar level, but less depressed by some degree than the DAX, is right around the 6,200 area on the FTSE 100 index. So where does that leave us? That segues right back over, not so much to the dollar, but the degree to which the worst we did, again, under that tragic Boston Marathon bombing, but the worst we did, even as the market was fearful of maybe follow-on events, that there might have been other terrorists out there, we got back down psychologically, but also importantly technically, because more elevated averages, more aggressive, fast-moving averages, 13-week average in the S&P 500 future, 1535. It was last week. We got to 1531, which is right where, psychologically, 1532, going all the way back to the middle of March, is the worst we did off the Cyprus crisis. The bad employment number, 1533. So they were right back down to where they held the previous psychology. Jack, you know, we don't have to get into all of it now because your listeners have heard it before.
Well, I'll tell you what,
I'm a bit skeptical, but when they hold these kind of levels, you can't be bearish.
I'll tell you what, we're going to come back. We're going to come all the way back. We're going to work our way around the world and come back to the U.S. at the end here. But I want to touch a little bit on some other things. I want to go to the Far East, but before I said that, you mentioned Boston. I just got to say, you know what, these terrorists are morons. Do they not know that? I mean, I know a few people from Boston. You know what? You don't mess with people from Boston. I don't care what you say.
No,
there are certain
right.
cities you don't mess with. Boston is one of them. You don't mess with these people.
And look at the coordinated effort. It shows we have come a long way.
But it's so funny because it's like the old Casablanca line when Rick was asked, you know, can you see us in New York? And he said, well, there are a few areas in New York I wouldn't recommend you invading.
Visiting.
You know what
Absolutely.
I mean? But that's kind of the way I feel. I said, these guys are idiots. They don't know what they were doing. But anyway,
right.
let's get around to the Far East for a second. I want to talk a little bit about what's going on out in China, what's going on in Japan. I came across something, and I want your reaction. Number one, to the moves that we're seeing in the yen, because I think that's very important. And number two, somebody said to me that we have woken up, at least Abe has, a giant when it comes to the markets right now with what's happened with Japan. The fact that the Japanese have done what they have done, all right, with Abenomics has given us the ability to be able to go out there and actually do what is necessary in our world, all right? But more importantly, the time to invest in Japan is now upon us again. Give me your take on that.
Well, I think the Japan, ultimately, when you get this kind of loosening, and if you get people in a little bit more of an upbeat mood, they have tremendous savings over there, and they've been scared, and they're sitting on it. So the Japanese will also be investing quite a bit more in Japan. In terms of the current timing, you know, the market's run up quite a long way, but you know, I don't want to use the previous bubble as my criteria. That would be silly to say, well, you know, ultimately the Nikkei is coming down from 40,000 before the crunch, you know, back in the 1990s. But even so, even looking at reasonably where the market might go, you know, it did get all the way back up in the last hopeful period, all the way back up to about 18.5. And even allowing that we're already up to 13.5, there's a heck of a base under this market now if it should react anywhere back down around 12,000.
It's more than a heck of a base. You're also talking about an entire change in psychology here, which gives the Japanese investor, the U.S. investor, the global investor, a complete different perception of what's going on in Japan. And, Alan, you and I were around when Japan was in its heyday, when it ran
right
to a 39,000 Nikkei. We watched that. I mean, I remember talk of the Japanese buying everything in sight here. That was the concern.
We'll all be working for the Japanese, and
I did work for the Japanese at the time. I worked for Nikko Securities.
They were known every single company in the country.
I guess my point is, you know what? We're not too far away from that also being something that we have to start paying attention to.
Well, and I think it gets back to the same kind of thing of why Germany was so successful. You can get an edge in your exports by depreciating your currency to some degree, and there's a good case to be made why the yen was too rich, why it was priced too high for
a while.
Have
we seen that day over? I mean, is the day of the strong yen behind us?
Well, let's put it this way. Just technically speaking, I don't trust, you know, purchasing power parity calculations because the markets rotate around those in large exaggerations. But you've got some pretty fair previous trading levels as well as targets based on major Fibonacci retracements. 100, from the time they started coming up from the low to mid-70s, 100 was one of my intermediate-term targets, and 105 would be pretty stretched out. So I think the yen's gone about as far as it can go organically and about as far as it can go before you do attract more, more of a reaction from, let's say, the G20. G20 gave it a wink and a nod at the meeting over the weekend and said, no, they're addressing internal policies, much like Draghi has said at the ECB press conferences. They're addressing internal dynamics, so it's not manipulation.
Alan, let's come to our shores here. You know what? A lot going on here. We saw that volatility last week. I saw, in my mind, nothing more than a 4% correction in the S&P 500. We saw about 60 handles from 93 on the upside all the way down to about 31 on the downside. It's exactly, for me, right in my sweet spot. I always say 3 to 5% is exactly what I love to see in a bull market. Give me your feel for things. Give me your take on it. And then we'll get into a little bit about what's coming out the rest of the week here over the course of the last 8 minutes or so we have.
There were so many ways in which there was support after the new high up at 1592.5 in the June S&P future. Now, that's also the lead contract now, so that's the big continuation high, as we like to call it. It was almost impossible to imagine without a further incentive, without a further negative influence, another, you know, further bombings, etc., that you were going to break the 1532 Cypress low. It's not just citing it after, look where it held, but I said, look, between that, and you know we've been talking about the gaps right below it at 30 to 25, it's like, what are the bears going to do? You had Fibonacci, weekly moving averages, the previous congestion from March and earlier this month in that area. It's like it was like the Great Wall of China, except it was the Great Wall of S&P.
Was that a good technical move? I guess, you know what, that's the real – whenever I talk to a technician, I always ask, was that a good technical move or was it a bad or a sloppy technical move? How would you perceive that?
It was a very consistent technical move insofar as Thursday, when it made the new low, it hung around for quite a while, somewhat above that 1532. It was up around 1542 to 38. And it drifted lower very quietly. At the end of the day, after a trade the 1532 in the last hour, it showed some real vigorous recovery back up, you know, even if it was only $5 or $8. But you could see the volatility was still on the upside in spite of the sharp break taking it down to that level from earlier in the week. And then by Friday, the market was up. And, you know, and that was it. You said, well, you tested it. Even if it was still going to be bad, it would have likely stopped back around the previous high from back in March at 1568. And we got up around, you know, near that level yesterday. We pushed through it today. So on current form, that move down was a very, what should I say, in short-term projection terms. We talked about this recently, Jack, how a lot of people following short-term technicals were getting chopped up. There were clear signs on given days, especially last Monday and again on Wednesday, that the market wanted to remain weak after the week opening. And yet by Thursday, it got very quiet into that level. And that's what you look for in a bull market. They can look ugly for a few days, but as you get back to support, it gets quiet, and the market suddenly starts going up faster than it's coming down.
Well, being quiet makes sense, because I've always heard from my mentors, never sell that sleeping market, and that's exactly what it seems to do.
Especially at the bottom of the
sell-off. At the bottom of that move. Hey, you know what? We saw that flash crash today, or at least something that was equivalent to a flash crash. I'm not going to call it that, only because I think it wasn't a crash.
It was a hiccup. We saw the flash hiccup today.
It was essentially the type of move that you and I, and I'd love for you to comment on that we would normally see in a few hours. Was there anything wrong in your minds with the fact that it moved as fast as it did? Because quite frankly, I think what it's going to start doing is it's going to allow traders to say, you know what, I'm going to stick in a fishing line down here.
Resting,
you know what I
order.
Mean? A resting order. Right. Yeah, exactly. I mean, I know I'd do that if I were, if I were actively trading the market and I were short or long.
Right. There wasn't necessarily anything wrong with it, but I think it shows the downside of high frequency trading, which is the algorithms tend to not only the buyers, the investment buyers, tend to be able to say, hey, I'll have a resting order, and if it's anywhere well above the low, not right at the low, when they go through that order, you're filled. It's not like the old days, it's electronic. If your order's in, if it trades through it, then you got filled on the way down. But what it shows is the degree to which the algorithms will create serial extensions of moves based only on weakness. Some systems say that's enough weakness, I want to sell for no reason.
But how different is that from a local in the pit that would see selling come in and say this market's weak and offer 500 lots and move the market down, which is essentially the same thing to me. I guess my only difference here in my mind is speed, Alan. There's going to be a lot that's going to be written
also
about that
subjective
move.
But the subjective nature.
We're never going to get rid of the speed. We're never going to get rid of it.
No, I don't think so. Not at this point. I mean, I'm saying I'm not a big fan of high-frequency trading, but there's no economic or investment basis on which you can or should outlaw it. And like you said, Jack, for investors, hey, I'm still skeptical of this market. I think you can sell off, $120 from the high. You could retest. Just getting back to the last significant trading we overran, you could find an excuse to retest 1470 to 1450 at some point in the S&P. $120 down. But you know what? When it gets there, if it stops, same thing. It's probably going to still maintain the overall bull trend.
Alan, we got a few minutes left here. Maybe about two. I'd love to get your take on what's coming out and what's important over the course of the next couple of days.
Monday? I'm not going to try and sing because we don't want to really annoy the audience, but Friday.
We got GDP, right?
You got GDP here, but before you get that, you have, and by the way, upgrades looking on GDP, by the way, in the UK prior to that, that would be on Thursday.
There's been a lot of bearishness going into this earnings period with this GDP number and everything
else. Well, but the GDPs are looking to be substantially upgraded. We're going to go from our 0.4 to 3.0. They're going to say, oh, look, it's going to improve. Now, whether or not it improves that far, that's fine. But, Jack, we get the dynamic duo Friday morning. Bank of Japan rate meeting. And know what they're doing now? Press conference. They went to school on Mario Draghi. I'm going to sit here and explain why I'm perfectly entitled to pump money.
Don't
you love it?
Alan Rohrbach, folks, again, that's why, we keep him on this show as often as we can. Again, this is always a pleasure being with you. The fastest half hour of my day now. Used to be an hour, but there were too many commercials in that, folks. I didn't like it that way. I like it much better this way, where we get to engage in the lively art of conversation. This is Jack Marugin. Have a marvelous day. I'll be talking to you tomorrow.
views and opinions expressed in the preceding program are not necessarily those of this radio station or its sponsors and should not be construed as legal, tax, or investment advice. You should always consult the appropriate advisor before making any financial decisions. All rights reserved.